You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We're your hosts. I'm Abby.
And I'm Katie. We're librarians at the Central Library. Originally, we had planned to share JMLL's COVID-19 tiered response plan with you on this episode, but the local situation developed so quickly, by the time the episode was done, it was out of date.
That's right. And so as you can hear, we are practicing social distancing. So Katie is calling into this, so we hope that the sound quality comes out all right. We have a growing list of resources available to you in the library's blog at jmrlblog.com, which we will link to in our show notes. Instead of our planned episode, we've got a recording of an event at the Northside Library from earlier this month to share with you. It's called So I Married a President: How to Become a First Lady in One Easy Step.
But before we get to that, you've got book chat.
All right, book chat. Katie, what did you read?
I read just recently a memoir. It's called Uncanny Valley by Anna Wiener. Mm-hmm. So it's been getting a lot of buzz recently, so probably heard of it.
Yes.
Yeah, so it is essentially a memoir of this woman. She worked in Silicon Valley in the 2010s, around that for a few years. And she was born and raised in New York, had been working in publishing at the time, and was, like most people working in publishing, just starting out pretty broke and felt stuck in her job. And that's when she read that there was a startup company in Silicon Valley out in like San Francisco, ebook publishing, or a platform they were selling ebooks on a subscription model with like $3 million to start with. And she's like, I'm in the wrong line of business. I need to get out of here. And so she went on a whim and started working there. And so what follows in the book, it's essentially like an observation of her time in Silicon Valley working there. And so she's talking about sort of really the height of the tech industry idealism in a way, where people are talking about like progress and being down for the cause and all that, you know, your typical Silicon Valley behavior that you expect. And so what drew me to this one is that she kind of has an outsider point of view in a way, because first of all, she's female working in the tech industry. And she's not really in the tech industry herself, because she's not like an engineer or software program. She works as customer service person. So she's, like on the phone or mostly doing chat, you know, those kind of things. So she gets sort of put down a lot when people say, or when she says, you know, the company she works for, they get all excited. And then she says, it's really customer service. And I'm like, look at her differently.
Interesting.
So that was kind of interesting, because she sees like one foot in the door sort of, but not quite. So she has a good point of view, a good perspective on what goes around. But she has great observations about the culture of the time, you know, that bro culture, which is still pretty prevalent. But just the things that she points out, like how they dress. Like she mentions they look like they're going to climb a glacier.
The hoodies.
The t-shirts, lots of t-shirts, And just the superficiality.
Do they have a ping pong table in the office?
Lots of ping pong table. A lot of like cereal bars and stuff. Everything you expect.
Good.
She mentions, But there was like a great anecdote where she talks about going camping with a group of other colleagues, and she's the only one who brings a tent, because like, we're not staying out here sleeping in a tent, and they all leave, and like, she had too much to drink, so she can't go home, and so she's like out in the middle of nowhere, afraid that, you know, the state police is going to show up. So it was pretty interesting. She does, I think if you've heard about the book, you've probably heard this weird quirk about it, where she doesn't name the companies. She uses like kind of coy references, which can get irritating at sometimes, because you're like, either you know who you're talking about, so you're like, would you say the name?
Right.
Or you can't figure out right away, so you kind of have to stop where you are.
Very frustrating.
Exactly. And she does kind of gloss over some of the big issues, but I think this is more about the time frame that she's writing in, where she mentions an NSA leaker, and so she's obviously talking about Edward Snowden.
Right.
And she leaves her tech job in 2018, so she's kind of escaping the fallout of the time. And so things like with Snowden, but some of the jobs that she has where she is kind of questionable practices with like user privacy and censorship. For one job, she works at GitHub, and so she's kind of moderating the discussion forums, and she's like, at what point is, you know, this going too far? And it's incredible to think that these people have control over
what?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, she doesn't have all the answers, of course. Nobody can. But I think it's a great introduction if you're not familiar with the tech industry and kind of make you second guess what is going on out there and what your role is in that, too.
Cool. Very cool.
So how about you? What have you read?
I also read a memoir.
Yeah.
A little out of character. I read Children of the Land by Marcelo Hernandez Castillo. And so this one is also getting a fair amount of buzz. And it just came out this year. He is a poet who grew up undocumented in the U.S. Mm-hmm. He immigrated with his family when he was like 5 from Mexico. And he was the... So he is a DACA recipient, and now he has a green card, a permanent resident card. But he was the first undocumented person to graduate with an MFA from the University of Michigan.
Wow.
And he's been really kind of instrumental in pushing to eliminate citizenship and residency requirements for major poetry prizes. So he's really kind of using his access to the publishing world, I think, to... push the causes of other people from similar backgrounds. So this is a memoir of kind of his family's struggle to stay in the United States where they've been for decades and kind of a failed struggle really to stay together. And it kind of chronicles their ongoing battles with, you know, every possible avenue they could try to become like legal documented residents. And it's really beautifully written because he is a poet. And he doesn't kind of gloss over the choices and kind of personality traits that make him and his family members, you know, less than perfect, which I think is really was a good choice because it's very humanizing, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, well, even if these people aren't perfect, no one deserves to be treated like
right.
this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, it was really beautifully written, and I... do recommend it. I know, I believe there's a short hold list, but I think it's worth the wait.
Great.
Next, we hear a recording of JMRL's historical collection librarian, Miranda Burnett, giving a presentation on several former first ladies in a program called So I Married a President, How to Become First Lady in One Easy Step.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Small. Ordinarily, we'd probably have about 40 or 45 people here today. So thank you for coming out. Welcome to the Northside Library. My name is Evan Stankovic, Adult Programming Librarian. Today's program, So I Married a President, or How to Become First Lady in One Easy Step, is being audio recorded for JMRL's podcast on the same page, which can be accessed through www.jmrl.org. So if somebody couldn't make it here today, we will have an audio recording go on our website. One thing I should also mention before I introduce today's speaker, for anybody curious, next Friday's program, Stories Untold, Oral Histories of Wives of Vietnam Servicemen, this program has been canceled. The speaker, I believe, is coming from Pittsburgh, so this has been canceled. So if you could just let anybody know if you know anybody who's interested in that program. With that said, I would now like to introduce to you today's speaker, Miranda Burnett, who is certainly no stranger to the Northside Library. In fact, until just several weeks ago, she was a reference librarian here at the Northside Library. Since then, Miranda has assumed her new role as historical collections librarian at the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. Historian and historical reenactor, Miranda Burnett's meticulous research on the Highlands enslaved families sold to Florida's Casabianca Plantation in 1828 was most recently the subject of a front-page New York Times article and drew international attention. Her passion for history is contagious, so when Miranda pitched this idea to me probably about 6 months ago, I knew that we were in for a very special treat this afternoon. So with that said, please help me welcome back to the Northside Library, Miranda Burnett.
Make sure this is on so everyone can hear well. So welcome. I gotta say, I am very glad that people have come today to see this presentation. So thank you for coming out and joining today. So many times our first ladies, they're hidden behind the men, behind the presidents. And today I'm going to highlight three first ladies. So Julia Gardner Tyler, Frances Folsom Cleveland, and Edith Bowling Gault Wilson. And I'll tell you why she has so many names when we get to her, but highlight them and their contributions to the role of First Lady And though these three women lived during three different time periods, their lives did overlap, and they also have something in common. They all became first lady by marrying a sitting president. So first, let's meet... Is it going forward? There we go. So let's meet what was known as the Rose of Long Island. This is Julia Gardner, and she's born in New York on May 4th of 1820. She was the third of four children, but the first daughter, born to David Gardner, who was a lawyer and a New York State senator, and to her mother, Juliana McLaughlin. So she was considered a beauty by the day's beauty standards, as you can see. Short and plump, with black hair and large dark eyes. But of course, I'm getting ahead of ourselves in the narrative just a little bit. So her childhood, she's part of the social elite of New York society. So as part of that, she has a formal education that's typical for girls of her status. She goes for 2 years to Madame Chambaret's Institute, which was a boarding school. And there she learned music, French literature, ancient history, arithmetic, and composition. Now, there was one topic at school that Julia very much excelled in, although it wasn't technically offered as a course. And this was the art of flirtation. And because of this, she acquired a string of suitors. Now, again, because of her status, all doors of society, they're open to her. And what she does, though, is 2 years after she leaves school, she causes a bit of a scandal. Because she is 19 years old, and she secretly posed for an engraving of a mass-produced lithograph advertisement for a dry goods and clothing store. And it's a little hard to read. It says it there on her handbag, but it says, "I'll purchase at Bogart's and McKemley's. Their goods are beautiful and astonishingly cheap." Now, what is scandalous about this is not just a woman in an advertisement, an elite woman in an advertisement, but also is that she is on an arm of a man who is not her spouse or a relative. And so to have this, to have a young unmarried woman's public exposure in a commercial venture for her family was humiliating. And then further embarrassment comes for the family when a poem titled "Julia, the Rose of Long Island" was published in the Brooklyn Daily News. Unfortunately, I was unable to find a copy of this poem, or else I would share it with you. But no luck in that department. So after this, what do her parents do? Well, they take her to a spa resort in White Sulphur Springs. That's what every parent does, right? Take your child on vacation. And while they're laying low there, they plan a year-long trip to Europe where they're going to do the grand tour. And they're going to present Julia to the Pope. She is going to be presented to King Louis-Philippe of France. It's kind of, in a sense, her punishment for this family's humiliation. So when they come back to the U.S., they spend their time in Washington, D.C. Remember, her father is a senator, so it's perfectly acceptable for them to go there. Again, because of the family's wealth and their social prominence, they are guaranteed entry to every circle, every social circle in Washington, including a welcome at the White House. After a season there, the family goes back to New York, and Julia is completely bored. So she persuades her father to take them back to Washington, where here she finds herself so besieged by Beau that the family have to rent a second room to serve as a parlor for entertaining visitors. Now, by this time, of course, President John Tyler, unfortunately, his wife, Letitia, had died. She had suffered a stroke a few years before, and really during the first few years of his presidency, the White House had been a rather somber place. Because his wife was an invalid, there just wasn't much entertaining and so forth. So after Mrs. Tyler's death, of course, the White House is still in mourning, but Tyler's daughter invites Julia and her sister to come and visit. And so it's during these visits to Tyler's daughter that the 52-year-old John Tyler becomes interested in the 22-year-old Julia. And he invites the Gardners to then dine at the White House and spend more time there. Finally, in February of 1843, the Gardners are invited to Washington's birthday ball. And there, Tyler whisks Julia away, dancing with her through the White House rooms and proposing marriage to her. Now, this is only 5 months after his first wife's death. Now, Julia refuses, but she also does not tell her parents what took place. She keeps that to herself. But by this time, all of Washington has been watching what's going on, so they are gossiping everywhere. A month later, Tyler proposes again. So Julia, she confesses feelings of affection for him and says yes, but she doesn't set a date yet. And really, her mother intervenes at this point and says she wants to make sure that Julia knows her own mind. Is this really what she wants? So the Gardners go back to New York, and John Tyler and Julia are exchanging letters practically every week. So almost a year later, Julia goes back to Washington, and a week later, an event changes her life. So on February 28, 1844, President Tyler and Julia, along with her father and sister, were part of a 350-guest gala excursion down the Potomac River on this new steam frigate. So other elite dignitaries included, of course, the president's cabinet, and also Dolly Madison, who is still kicking it at this time. Of course, the highlight of the excursion is the firing of, at this time, the world's largest naval gun called the Peacemaker. So it was the gun was discharged twice to a cheering crowd, who then they went below deck of the ship for food and drink. As the ship passes by Mount Vernon, someone suggests that the gun be fired in honor of President Washington. But this time, the gun's side exploded, spraying hot metal and shrapnel across the deck and into the crowd. It killed two top officials, one the Secretary of State, the other the Secretary of the Navy, who, as a side note, was Thomas Walker Gilmer from Albemarle County. And also killed in this was Julia's father. Of course, Julia and majority of the guests were actually below deck at this time. So when Julia hears the news, she faints. And who carries her off the boat? John Tyler. So shortly after this, Julia finally set a date for the wedding. And he's going to the next. There we go. There's a newspaper article from when they set the date. The Tylers had a secret wedding on June 26th of 1844 in New York. Only one of John's seven living children was present. So Julia's mother and sister and her two brothers came. So news of the wedding was published the next day, and this really shocked everyone, particularly John Tyler's daughters, who were close in age to their new stepmother and had no clue that this was actually happening. There's the church where they were married, and then a description from a newspaper of how Julia was dressed for her wedding. So now she is First Lady, so the very first president to be married while in office. So now Julia's tenure as First Lady is the shortest of all the First Ladies. She was only there for 8 months. That's because at the end of Tyler's first term, he decided not to run again. So she was only there 8 months, but she made the most of that short time relishing her new role. So remember what she, shall we say, majored in at Madame's school in New York, right? So the White House had been somber before, of course, with the illness and the death of the first Mrs. Tyler. It's now filled with lavish entertainments, and the president also seems to regain his former humor, according to friends and family. So now Julia is the first known First Lady to overtly seek newspaper coverage. And had them report on her social events. She widely disseminated portraits, and so she permitted the engravings of her face that were mass-produced and sold. And she also gave permission for her name to be used on sheet music for the popular polka waltzes. And so this is called the Julia Waltzes. And hopefully this will work. Here is what the Julia Waltzes sounds like. Exactly something that makes me want to get up and cut a rug, but so this is from around 1845 when this was written. All right. So now some of Julia's actions, some historians have said, were influenced by another prominent Washington, D.C. resident, of course, Dolly Madison, who's very well known for her entertainments during her time as First Lady. At this time, Dolly lives across the street from the White House, and she also travels with Julia to New York to visit friends and family there. So who knows really how much influence Dolly had upon Julia, but Julia was very much I don't want to say attention-seeking, but, you know, putting that role of First Lady out there that had not quite been done before. For Julia, though, the role of First Lady was larger than simply being the spouse of the president and the hostess of the White House. One thing that she was trying to do is make the role of First Lady worthy of national notice on its own terms. So she also changed the White House in other ways. She is credited with requesting that Hail to the Chief be played anytime the president enters the room. And she began the tradition of donating a portrait of the First Lady to the White House. And that is her First Lady portrait. So more importantly, Julia adopted her husband's causes as her own, praised his writing and speeches, and came to defend him against all criticisms. The annexation of Texas was the hot political topic during Tyler's presidency, and Julia joined John's fight with Congress over the issue. She spent countless hours dining with and lobbying senators, representatives, and their wives, encouraging them to support John in annexation. When President Tyler signed the Texas Resolution, he gave Julia the pin he used. She had the pin made into a necklace and wore it to her grave. Literally, she was buried with it around her neck. So when her husband's first term ended in 1845, they made their way to his Virginia home on the James River, of course, Sherwood Forest. Julia enjoyed dancing. So the story is Tyler had this long ballroom built so that they could do the Virginia Reel. Afterwards, they have 7 children. So this puts the total number of Tyler children at 15, making John Tyler the president with the most children. And as a side note, 2 of his grandchildren are still alive. We won't go into the details of how that works, but just trust me, there's still 2 grandchildren alive. And one of them, I believe it's the one that's on the right, he owns and lives in the Tyler home, Sherwood Forest, currently. Let's see. So even though Julia, she was born in New York, when she comes to Virginia, she embraces Southern ways. With the spread of abolitionist movement worldwide, the Duchess of Sutherland in England sent an open letter supporting abolition to the American news and media. Julia fumed over this letter and published a rebuttal. And there you can see a copy of the rebuttal. So she is, in this letter, she's attacking the British abolitionist interference in American affairs. When the Civil War began, John Tyler attempted to follow a moderate course, but eventually he and Julia supported the Confederacy, with John serving shortly as a member of the Confederate Congress. And I say serving shortly because he lived only a few weeks into his term, dying January 18th, 1862 at the Exchange Hotel in Richmond at age 71. Now, given, shall we say, his political past, obituaries go at each end of the spectrum. There's one on the left side where it's, you know, praising him. At the very end, it says, you know, he was an honest but not a great man, but kind of, you know, praising his work as president. And then you have the other side on the right, the traitor ex-president, let his name rot. So that is, unfortunately, John Tyler's end. Now, for Julia, this leaves her a widow with 7 young children at the age of 41. So though she stayed at Sherwood Forest during the first half of the Civil War, she spent the remaining years of it in New York. In 1872, she moved to Washington. Oh, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. There's his gravesite. There's where she spent in New York from 1868 to 1874. And, of course, afterwards styles herself as the ex, as Mrs. Ex-President Tyler. And she launches a campaign to get Congress to grant a pension for presidential widows, asking for the same $3,000 that Mrs. Lincoln received. So Julia was granted $1,200 a year, but following President Garfield's assassination, all presidential widows were awarded $5,000 a year, which she then received. Now, remember the age difference between her and John Tyler? She even received a pension of $8 a month as a widow of a veteran of the War of 1812. So in July of 1889, while staying at the Exchange Hotel, the same hotel her husband was at, Julia Gardner Tyler died of a stroke at the age of 69. Not in the same room that her husband died. It was down the hallway. Of course, she is buried beside her husband in Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond. Now, in 2007, the U.S. Mint authorized First Lady coins. And they've been released, I think it's 4 a year for the First Ladies. And so there is a coin for Julia Tyler. And on the first side, you'll see her face. And in the back side, something that represented the First Lady. And so in this case, the artist decided to use waltzing as Julia's legacy. Now, 3 years before Julia's death, another White House wedding was the talk of the nation. And here's our next lady, Frances Folsom Cleveland. So she is born 10 months after her parents, Oscar and Emma Folsom's marriage, born on July 21st, 1864 in Buffalo, New York, at a house on Edward Street. So from the time of her birth, she was actually known as Frank, not Frances. She was Frank, and she didn't use the name Frances until after her wedding. So her father was a lawyer, and one of his law partners and a very close friend was a gentleman named Stephen Grover Cleveland. You may recognize him more from this image, right? And you may also be able to predict where this story is going as well. So Frank, as I shall call her, she was really given the best education, again, for females at this time. She began at Madame Brecker's French kindergarten and then continued to Miss Bissell's School for Young Ladies. She spent summers at her maternal grandmother's estate near Medina in upstate New York. And it was there in 1874, shortly after her 10th birthday, that she and her mother learned tragic news from Buffalo. Her father had been killed in a carriage accident. So he was always known to be racing his horse and carriage at any opportunity available. And at this incident, he had been driving at full speed into Buffalo, and he tried to pass another vehicle when the wheel skidded and overturned the carriage. Oscar was thrown from it, landing on his head. So Frank stayed with her grandmother while her mother returned to Buffalo to make the funeral arrangements. Now, her father left them with a rather comfortable estate, and his will named an executor. Any guesses who the executor is? Of course, his law partner and friend, Grover Cleveland. So after the funeral, Frank and her mother lived briefly with her aunt in St. Paul, Minnesota, but 6 months later returned to her grandmother's home in Medina, where Frank attended the Medina Academy for Boys and Girls until 1879. And due to her naming preference, remember a Frank, she was routinely listed for boys' activities. So the family moved back to Buffalo, where Frank attended Central School, but she left her senior year, obtaining certification of her completed studies, and was admitted to the second semester of the freshman class at Wells College. Oh, there's her home, her grandmother's home, where she spent time. And there she is, or there's Wells College. Put it this way, she absolutely loved college life. She studied botany, astronomy, and logic, but she particularly enjoyed political science. She was an active member of the theater club, helping to build sets, sew costumes, and even acted. She was also a member of the debating club. It was a club called the Phoenix Society. And she once delivered a complicated speech on free trade, the tariff, and protectionism. So Wells College had strict social codes, and the principal kept a list of each girl's approved correspondence. Any guesses who was on Frank's list? Of course, Grover Cleveland. And there's one right at the very end of her college days. So while at college, Frank received two marriage proposals in one day. She accepted the first, but she let the engagement decline into friendship. And she later wrote to her mother, "When I marry, it must be someone more than a year older than I am, someone I can look up to and respect." So while at college, of course, family friend Clover Grover Cleveland, who at this time, who right before this had been the mayor of Buffalo, he was now governor of New York. So in addition to writing to Frank, Cleveland sends her newspapers and pamphlets, of course, for her interest in political science, and also weekly baskets of flowers from the governor's mansion greenhouses. Now, with Cleveland's election to the presidency in 1884, Frank and her mother were invited to the March 4th, 1885 inauguration, but it conflicted with Frank's final exams at Wells, which I think also shows you really where her priorities lie at this moment. They did go later to visit Cleveland at the White House. This is toward the end of March, and these are various newspaper articles talking about that visit. When they went to Washington, Cleveland arranged to show her the top of the Washington Monument, even though it had not been yet opened to the public. And this sounds a little cliched. Grover and Frank also enjoyed long walks and conversations together after dinner. So it was not a complete surprise when he proposed to her. She accepted his proposal, and she wanted to marry immediately. But Grover insisted that she go to Europe on the planned tour with her family. He said he wanted her to see new places, meet new people, and think carefully about their future, even writing that he wished from the bottom of his heart that he was not president so that she would not be exposed to public gaze. So Frank spent a year in Europe. Of course, seeing the trip as another year of education, she walked the streets of London and Berlin, the streets of Pompeii, looking into Mount Vesuvius. She and Grover agreed that they would marry the moment of her return to the United States. And in the White House, because Grover thought that every young woman deserved a beautiful wedding. He even purchased a diamond necklace as a wedding present for her. Now, during her time in Europe, the newspapers were rife with gossip, and Frank and her mother were chased by reporters upon their return to the United States. They took a late train to Washington, arriving on the morning of her wedding, June 2nd, 1886. So you can really see, like, the second she returns to the United States a few days later, she is going to her own wedding. So they arrived the morning of June 2nd. Her husband-to-be is still working as president that day, but he took some time to confer with the Presbyterian minister, and specifically to alter the service a bit. They were striking out the word obey and putting in keep instead. So at 7 p.m. that evening, the Marine Band struck up the wedding march, and Grover and Frances appeared at the top of the stairs together. So on this day, Frances Folsom, now Cleveland, became the youngest First Lady at only age 21. And if you are curious, there is a 27-year age difference between Grover Cleveland and Frances Folsom. So they honeymooned at Deer Park, Maryland, but they were not alone in their bliss. As you can see, this illustration shows newspapermen following them. And really, they did. The newsmen swarmed the resort. They climbed trees with binoculars and telescopes. They pretty much followed their every move. Now, upon the return to Washington, the Clevelands hosted two receptions. And at both of those, Frances wore her wedding dress. And so there is her wedding dress and then the photo that was taken shortly thereafter. Now, Washington society marveled at the new First Lady's poise and charm, and foreign dignitaries commented on her fluent French. But the public gaze severely intruded in Frank's life. So weekly illustrated newspapers, such as Harper's, made her a frequent cover girl. Young women copied her hairstyle and even the poses she took in formal photographs. And not only was Frank's clothing style copied, it was also criticized. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was alarmed that the young First Lady wore gowns that bared her shoulders and petitioned her to stop wearing such clothing because it was an evil influence on young American girls. So put it this way, Frances didn't respond to this petition, and she didn't stop wearing the style of gowns that she enjoyed. There was also commercial merchandising that appeared with her image. So one, there's a trading card that's there on the left, and then an ashtray with her image on it. There's also sheet music devoted to her. And so we'll listen very quickly. First will be the Lady Cleveland Gavotte, and then afterwards, the Lady of the White House Grand March. And these were all written and dedicated to Frances Cleveland. The next one's the Grand March. There we go. So she even appears on tobacco products. There's a trading card and then a pipe with her face on it. Let's see. There's also, next one's a calendar. So, you know, a lot of these trade goods are just, you know, given away to customers, and they're using her face on them. But the most exploitive and offensive, really, advertising were the businesses who made no effort to mask the claim that Frank owned or bought their items. So they incorporated her into scenarios. So here it is. It's assumed that she enjoys Merrick thread. This is fun. They depict her picking out fabrics. And then even, you know, sitting down to a brand new sewing machine. There was another one that she's being led to a brand new piano. This problem became so pervasive that congressmen attempted to pass a bill that would halt any use of a woman's image for commercial purposes without her written permission. Unfortunately, the bill failed to even come up for a vote in the House, opening the floodgates even wider to exploit her image. So after her first time as First Lady, and that's a little bit of foreshadowing there, Frank came to use her influence in her role as First Lady for projects she considered more uplifting for her countrywomen. Now, in the spring after her marriage, Frank returned to New York to participate in Wells College graduation ceremonies, where she and another classmate were elected the first women trustees of the college. And this was a position that Frank would hold for more than 50 years. As First Lady, she also accompanied her husband on extended trips through the country. Traveling across the South and West, where more citizens than ever before viewed a presidential couple, and accumulated more than 5,000 miles of travel time. And this is Harper's Weekly documenting their trip in October of 1887. Now, Grover campaigned for re-election in 1888, and though he won the popular vote, he lost the electoral vote or electoral college to Benjamin Harrison. And so the Clevelands planned to retire to New York City, where they settled into an ordinary life. On October 3rd, 1891, their first child, Ruth, was born. But a year later, with voters disenchanted by President Harrison, Grover was nominated for the presidency, and his election in 1892 put an end to their quiet domestic life. So when they move back into the White House, so Frances is also the first lady to serve two non-consecutive terms as First Lady. When they moved back into the White House, and there's her inauguration dress for 1892, she was expecting their second child. So a daughter, Esther, was born September 9th, 1893, and became the first presidential child to be born in the White House. In the past, there have been presidential grandchildren, but this is the first presidential child to be born in the White House. Of course, if you remember her first term as First Lady, advertisers used her image. Here's what they did as well, and you'll see their three daughters in other advertising images. So now Frank's concern during her second time as First Lady really was to be with her children as much as possible. And after the birth of their third daughter, Marion, she created a kindergarten at the White House that included not only her own children, but also the children of the diplomatic corps as well. Frank continued her hostess role as First Lady, and of course, as I previously mentioned, used this role for uplifting purposes. She continued, she hosted Saturday afternoon receptions for working women and young mothers who were unable to visit the White House during the work week. And of course, this shocked some of the White House staff that they were letting in common shop girls and other service industry workers into the regal East Room to shake the First Lady's hand. But Frank made a point of greeting everyone. She went to a ceremony to mark the opening of an educational opportunity for factory workers. And so she was always a strong supporter of women's education and, as I mentioned, continued to be an active trustee of Wells College and helped to found the University Women's Club. Frank also assisted a Washington African-American woman to establish the Washington Home for Friendless Colored Girls. So using her position to assist those in need, she was one of the most visible members of the Colored Christmas Club, which was a charity that provided food and clothing to poor local children. And she began at this time to work with the Needlework Guild of North America to supply warm clothing to those who needed it, particularly as an economic depression had hit the nation in 1893. Now, after completing the second term, the Clevelands moved to a home in Princeton, New Jersey, where their first son was born in 1897. And they settled into a routine of spending winters in Princeton and summers at a cottage in Massachusetts. So another child, Frances, was born in 1903. But tragedy struck the family the next year when their eldest daughter, So 12-year-old Ruth died of diphtheria. 4 years later, Grover Cleveland died, leaving 44-year-old Francis with four children, ranging in age from 14 to 4. So as the widow of a president, she was entitled to the $5,000 pension, which she never took. 5 years later, 48-year-old Francis remarried to Thomas Preston. And I always have to laugh at this newspaper image. I mean, there are arrows in Francis's chest from Cupid. So it's that melodramatic time of the early 1900s. Of course, Francis, I should call her now, continued her involvement with Wells College, and she even headed the endowment fund in 1922. When her son Francis began a summer theater troupe, she eagerly participated, traveling with them to sell tickets. Almost none of the theatergoers knew that the charming woman who was in the box office had once been mistress of the White House. In later years, her eyesight began to fail, and she learned Braille and acquired a Braille typewriter to make transcripts for young blind students. And she continued to do this even after successful cataract surgery. We have a few more images of her. Here she is working. This one taken sometime between 1915 and 1920. Here she is later years as president of the Needlework Guild. And this is a very fun one. This was taken a year before her death, and she's there with First Lady Edith Wilson, who we'll be talking about next, former President Herbert Hoover, and President and First Lady Truman. Now, during a visit to her son Richard in Baltimore, Frances died in her sleep on October 29, 1947. A small private service was conducted at Princeton, and she was buried in the cemetery there. And there is her grave marker. So the press coverage of her tenure as First Lady had focused on her clothes and her appearance, and it really overshadowed her work in education, sponsoring public kindergarten and college education for women. So while First Lady, she set a tone of grace and elegance at the White House, but once she was out of Washington and away, she wanted only her family. And then, of course, I mentioned her the First Lady coin program. She gets two coins since she was the 22nd and 24th First Lady. And so the top one you can see here, of course, shaking hands with those working shop girls, as she was criticized by White House domestic staff. And then the bottom one, their presidential tours. And so our last First Lady is now Edith Bowling Galt Wilson. So she was born, of course, Edith Bowling in Wytheville, Virginia, October 15th of 1872. She was the seventh of 11 children. And her parents were Judge William Bowling and Sarah White. Now, from her father's side of the family, Edith was a direct descendant of Pocahontas. So this was her her birthplace in Wytheville. Her childhood was filled with a sprawling extended family. So both of her grandmothers and several aunts and cousins lived with the family. Most nights, there were anywhere from 15 to 20 people eating at the dinner table. Now, Edith shared a room with her grandmother, who was disabled and confined to her bed. And it was Edith's responsibility to wash her grandmother's clothing, turn her in bed at night, and look after her grandmother's 26 canaries. Her grandmother also taught her to read and write, but Edith, unlike her older sisters, had no formal education until her father enrolled her at Martha Washington College in Abington. The college had a rigorous curriculum, and Edith was, shall we say, ill-prepared for school. She complained about the food and the cold rooms, and she dropped out after just one semester. 2 years later, her father sent her to Powell's School for Girls in Richmond. Of course, later in life, Edith described her time at Powell's as the happiest time in her life. But, unfortunately for her, the school closed after a year due to an accident suffered by the headmaster, and Edith's father refused to pay for any more schooling. So afterward, Edith goes to D.C. to visit her sister and her brother-in-law. And there she meets Norman Galt, a cousin of her brother-in-law. So Norman is 9 years Edith senior, and he was a prominent jeweler of Galt and Brothers, which had been described as the Tiffany's of Washington, D.C. So after 4 years, she finally agrees to marry him, and the ceremony being held in 1896. And they spend the next 12 years in Washington. Their family life, though, was filled with tragedy. In 1903, Edith gave birth prematurely to a boy who lived only 3 days. And this difficult birth also left her unable to bear more children. But in spite of this, the Galts were an affectionate couple. Norman gave her the first electric car in D.C., and there's a picture of her in her automobile along with her driver's license. They traveled to Europe in 1907, but a few months after their return, Norman became ill and died from a liver infection. He was only 43 years old. So a widow at age 35, Edith had to decide what to do with Norman's jewelry business. She decided to keep the business and hired a manager for the store, for she was already a well-known personality in Washington and was routinely taking trips to Europe. 8 years after her first husband's death, Edith was introduced to Woodrow Wilson by Woodrow's cousin, Helen Bones. Now, Helen had been serving as the official White House hostess after the death of Wilson's first wife, Ellen. So Edith is invited to tea in March of 1915, where she's introduced to Wilson, and let's just say it was love at first sight. She dined regularly at the White House, and she and Woodrow wrote letters almost daily, and this is one of the little notes written to each other, and his question is, "Dearest, a question before I sleep. I suppose there can be no drive this afternoon. Can there?" I don't know what her response was to that one. So they attended baseball games together. They rode around Washington in an open car. And 2 months after they met, Woodrow proposed. Edith protested that it was too soon after Ellen's death, which hadn't even been a year by this point. But Edith also made it clear that she was open to his proposal. When Edith was invited to summer with Woodrow's cousin Helen in New Hampshire, it was understood that Woodrow would come and join them later. When he came, Woodrow again proposes, and this time Edith accepts, but she insists that they postpone the wedding until the end of the year. And again, as we know, newspapers enjoy the gossip, and so these are a few of the newspaper headlines that we're going through during this time. You know, will he marry again, and so forth. And there's one, you know, happy turn in life of the nation's chief. So they were finally married on December 18, 1915, at Edith's home in Washington, D.C. She wore a black velvet gown with purple orchids at her shoulder and a black velvet hat. And in case you're wondering, in the case of this couple, there's a 16-year age difference. Not as bad as the other two. this is a note written that she writes to Woodrow after their first anniversary, and then another wedding anniversary gift that he gives to Edith. This is one of her dresses that she wears around the time that they are married. So as First Lady, though, Edith faced the challenges of war. So World War I was raging in Europe, and of course this caused tension among diplomats in European countries. Woodrow had already confided foreign policy secrets to Edith during their courtship, and she became his closest confidant. When the U.S. finally entered the war in June of 1917, Edith fully embraced the influence she could have as First Lady to be an example for other women. Edith was a role model for wartime frugality and productivity. She asked the other wives of cabinet members to join her in buying only plain clothes and living as simply as possible. She volunteered at the Red Cross canteen, handing out hot coffee and sandwiches to troops coming through by train. She sewed pajamas, sheets, and pillowcases for the Red Cross. She even planted a war garden on the White House grounds, and instead of having labor mow the White House lawn, sheep were put there to graze. So the Food and Drug Administration offered conservation guidelines such as wheatless and meatless days, and participants could sign the Hoover Pledge to observe these guidelines, and if they signed it, they would receive a sticker to put in their window. Edith was the first woman to sign the pledge, and there's her signature. And then, of course, the way advertising works, then they use it to get more people to sign the pledge. And, of course, she proudly displayed her sticker, and this is the sticker that was given out, displayed that in the White House window. The Wilsons even observed gasless Sundays, using a horse and carriage to go to church. But of all these activities, the most important to Edith was to protect Woodrow's health, particularly during the strain caused by war. It was in her protection of his health that Edith became the most controversial First Lady of all time. So after the armistice on November 11, 1918, Woodrow and Edith traveled to Paris for the Paris Peace Conference. Not only was this the first time a sitting president had gone to Europe, it was also the first time a First Lady had accompanied her husband on a state visit. During this time, Woodrow's health deteriorated. His handwriting became worse, and he was very irritable and illogical, and at times had difficulty remembering things. Edith encouraged him to walk and play golf. Even after returning to the U.S., his health was precarious. So combine all of this with the opposition of the Senate to the Treaty of Versailles, and you're starting to have a recipe for disaster. Now, Woodrow, accompanied by Edith, decided to take his support for the Treaty of Versailles to the people with a cross-country train trip. This was going to be 21 days to the West Coast, making speeches every day, meeting people, and pretty much unable to rest. As they returned toward Washington, Woodrow suffered debilitating headaches and shortness of breath. Edith knew something had happened to him. He continued to have headaches even after his return. And while watching a moving picture, or a movie, shall we say, in the White House, Woodrow's doctor noticed that he was drooling slightly. The next day, Edith found Woodrow awake in bed but unable to move. His left side was paralyzed. The cause was a stroke, the blockage of an artery in the brain. Now, the decisions that Edith now made would have a huge impact upon the way that Woodrow was viewed when he left office. She moved to conceal the full extent of Woodrow's health from the public, and she immersed herself in the workings of the government, and she became the gatekeeper to Woodrow. So she decided who and which matters of state were important enough to bring to her bedridden husband. She screened his communications, deciding what he should see and what could wait. And, of course, all of this led to charges that she was the president in petticoats. And though Edith was, put this out, Edith was criticized for assuming executive power. No one has ever questioned her devotion to Woodrow or her efforts to make him well. So during the 4 years of marriage before his stroke, of course, she had become his closest advisor. And so during this time, she is acting accordingly to what she believed Woodrow would have wanted. Now, Woodrow's health did gradually improve by the time he left office in 1921. But before leaving office, though, there was the presidential election of 1920. And who is newly enfranchised? Edith. She becomes the first First Lady to vote for president 100 years ago. So afterward, the Wilsons moved to a house in D.C. where Edith cared for Woodrow until his death 3 years later. Afterwards, she made Woodrow's legacy her mission, shaping his image, revising, and even censoring unflattering portrayals of him. Exerting control over Woodrow's papers, she denied permission to even old friends to quote them. She did begin to donate some of his letters to the Library of Congress in the 1930s, but she still controlled access to them. University of Virginia lobbied for his papers, and she denied them, even preventing Princeton, where Woodrow had been university president, prevented them from having copies of his papers. Eventually, she donated Woodrow's personal library, right around 9,000 books, to the Library of Congress. So though she worked tirelessly to promote Woodrow's legacy, she was skeptical about a tribute proposed by the Woodrow Wilson Birthplace Memorial Association in Stanton. But she gradually warmed to the idea, even conferring with the board president about wallpapers at the site. In 1932, Edith attended the formal opening of what is now the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library and Museum. Other public appearances, including attending the Veterans Garden Party during the Eisenhower administration, which was an event that she had begun in 1918, and of course, JFK's inauguration on a freezing cold day in 1961. And she later admitted to keeping warm during the inauguration with a flask of bourbon. And there she is with JFK as he's signing a bill to create Wilson Memorial in D.C. So Edith died December 28, 1961, ironically on Woodrow's birthday. She was age 89 and buried beside Woodrow. So she still had one lasting legacy from her time as First Lady, and this is to the Constitution. So her assumption of power during Woodrow's illness was well known to the drafters of the 25th Amendment, which was ratified in 1967. And this amendment guarantees the vice president will become acting president if the president is unable to discharge his duties and powers. And then, of course, her coin, I think very lovingly, shows her with a hand over Woodrow's and helping him during his time of illness. And there we are, the three first ladies who became first lady by marrying sitting presidents. It's an easy process, isn't it? I hope that you learn not only just, you know, a few fun facts, but I also hope that you're inspired to learn more about all of the other first ladies. And I would be really remiss in my duties as a librarian if I didn't point out all of the resources that JMRL has on First Lady biographies, ones from Martha Washington all the way up to Michelle Obama. The newest one has not been written yet. That's why it's up to Michelle Obama. So yes, they can be found over the far corner by the windows in the biography section if you're interested in reading about any other First Ladies. We do have some time for questions if anyone has any. Mm-hmm.
The Washington Post had an article recently about this woman. They're going to put a museum in the Withville about her.
Yeah. I believe there already is a museum. I think it's been there for some time. I haven't been down to visit yet, though. That's on my to-do list to go down there. But I'm fairly certain there is already an Edith Wilson birthplace there in Withville. Mm-hmm. Oh, and you had
What about her, or Wilson's treatment of the suffragettes? How did she respond to that?
She kept her mouth shut.
But she probably voted,
yeah. And that was kind of one of her things, too, is... I'm not going in public. I am not going to do anything or say anything that goes against my husband's policies. So she was mum about it. You can go through and read old newspaper articles. She won't have a word. But then clearly, when she is given the right to vote, she uses it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, you have one?
Mm-hmm. Does the library have William Hazelgrove's Madam President?
Ooh. You'll have to ask the information desk after that one.
We can take a look in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Because that's all about that time period in which he ran the country while he was sick.
Now there is...
Madam
President, yes. Yeah. So we do have that one.
Yeah. And I think he mentions in there that there is some sort of museum birthplace in Woodville.
Yes, there is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's really startling if you've read that book, if you read that book.
I read it years ago.
And his doctor held, and the information that they withheld from the public.
Exactly. I think that book was published 2012.
2016.
Was it 2016? Okay.
I think so. Yeah, I just read a little bit.
I would say seems to me in the past decade it was published.
Yeah.
But that is really a good book, The Madame President.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you have one in the back?
I was just interested, you picked out these three ladies. Have you done extensive extensive research on other first ladies, or is that something in the
future? Yes. So I've also presented on so how this idea came about. I had done presentations on 5 Virginia first ladies. So I had done Ellen Wilson, and of course Edith, and then the first Mrs. Tyler, Letitia, followed by Julia, and then Elizabeth Monroe, because in my spare time, I like to dress up as Elizabeth Monroe, and sorry, I'm one of the Elizabeth Monroe reenactors. There's 2 of us, as far as I know, in Virginia. So I've done those, and then I've been invited for the summer, again, the Camp Young at Heart, which takes place over at Alderman's, and this year's theme is going to be mid-century first ladies. So I want to touch on Mrs. Truman, Mrs. Eisenhower, and so forth. So, yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much for coming out.
Well, I loved getting to hear from JMRL's historical collection librarian, Miranda Burnett.
Oh, yeah, me too. And she definitely knows a lot about her first ladies.
Yes. This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org. Unfortunately, due to the COVID-19 outbreak, the Friends of the Library have postponed their spring sale until a not yet determined time, but we will keep you updated as we find out more.
Yes, for sure. In the meantime, please hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to the podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org.
That's all for us today. We'll be back soon with more content. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be
on the same page.